all across Wisconsin from Civic Media. This is Up North News Radio. Now, live from our Lake Wissota studio, here's the founding editor of Up North News, Pat Kreitlow.
And welcome back to the second hour of Up North News Radio for this Tuesday, February 28th. Coming up this hour, rural Wisconsin and Tony Evers' budget proposal. There's a lot in there for Wisconsin's rural economy. There are direct investments in roads, bridges, broadbands, schools. But there's also targeted help for farm exports, modernizing dairy processing plants, helping food pantries to stay stocked with fresh Wisconsin-grown products. We will talk to Lincoln County farmer Hans Breitenmoser a little later on this hour about that. We will check in with weatherology meteorologist Jennifer Wojcicki, and in our Civic Media homeroom, we'll have Chad Holmes of Bull Falls Radio. As always, you can reach us at 844-967-2789 or 715-388-7155. The spring general election is 5 weeks from today, so we thought we would use the occasion to play back some excerpts from our recent interview with Milwaukee County Judge Janet Protasiewicz. We also reached out to the campaign of conservative former Justice Dan Kelly, but have not received a response. So if you missed it the first time around, in this excerpt, we asked Judge Protasiewicz to talk about why she chose to run, what the big issues in this race are all about, and why she thinks she's the better choice on April 4th. But we started by asking her about her personal biography.
I was born and raised on the south side of Milwaukee to teachers, really hardworking parents. And, you know, they instilled in me a number of things. You're going to work really hard, you're going to study hard, and you're going to give back to your community. And that's just what I've done. I worked my way through undergrad. I worked while I was in law school. I wasn't able to work my way through law school, meaning I did have debts when I left law school. But what I really wanted to do was continue to give back to the community and work with people. So when I graduated from Marquette Law School, I was very honored to be appointed an assistant district attorney in Milwaukee County. And I worked there for a quarter of a century, handling really complicated, you know, criminal litigation issues across the board. Worked at Children's Court. Milwaukee County has a Children's Court separate from a downtown division where we work with children who are, you know, abused or neglected that need services. Children who are in homes that aren't appropriate for them. We're working very, very hard to get them permanency, to have them adopted by, you know, fit, loving, adoptive parents. And so, you know, I had the Children's Court work, worked hard protecting victims, worked hard protecting our community for those 25 years, and then I decided to run for judge in Milwaukee County and been honored to have that position since 2014.
What, in your case, what made you say, okay, I'm ready to move from this position with individuals I'm helping or guiding or sentencing all the time to something more like a state Supreme Court?
Well, I'm honored and I love the position that I currently hold. So I want to start out with that. But I would say this. The stakes are absolutely so high in this race. I started thinking about this race last April. And it is not a cliche when I say I got into this race to save democracy for our state. I mean it. Everything that we care about is on the line, and everything that we care about is likely going to come into our Supreme Court chamber. And, you know, I have to be careful with how I structure responses, given that I'm running for a judicial post. But I tell people about my values. And values in regard to our gerrymandering and our maps issue. And I say that everybody deserves to be represented and represented in a fair way and where their votes are meaningful. And, you know, Wisconsin's a battleground state. And you look at the state of Wisconsin and you look at how close these statewide races are. And then you look at our maps and you have to recognize that something is wrong and that our Supreme Court allowed that, as compared to the dissent, you know, in the gerrymandering case, which I would say that I would agree with. Women's right to choose. I can tell you that, you know, that 1849 near total ban on abortion is going to stand if one of the far right extreme opponents wins this race. I think it's likely that even the results of the 2024 presidential election are going to come into the Supreme Court chamber, just like the results of the 2020 election did. So I think that the stakes are just so incredibly high, and that's why I decided to run.
Final question is about the general election campaign. Again, we've already seen the national attention that is going to come to this race. What concerns do you have about what that campaign is going to get to be like with national attention if you are a part of it?
I don't know that I would have concerns. My biggest concerns about these races always have to do with outside money coming in. And we know that our United States Supreme Court allowed that in Citizens United. So we have a situation where, you know, I think potentially substantial amounts of money. We already know $6 million has been spent on this race so far, and we're 10 days outside of the primary. So I don't think the national attention is a bad thing. I think that's a good thing for the state of Wisconsin, and it certainly magnifies and has a light on, you know, all of these important issues. It's the spending, I think, is certainly an issue. We're hearing, you know, one group has pledged anywhere between $10 and $30 million to Dan Kelly in this race. It's shocking amounts of money.
It really is. Milwaukee County Judge Janet Protasiewicz, thank you so much for talking about your candidacy for state Supreme Court. We really appreciate the visit. And again, that was Judge Janet Protasiewicz talking. This was a couple of weeks ago as we were heading up into the primary election. And again, we did reach out to the conservative candidates, Waukesha County Judge Jennifer Doro, and then former Justice Dan Kelly, who ultimately prevailed in the primary. And he and Judge Protasiewicz will face off on April 4th in a race that will determine control of the Wisconsin Supreme Court, something that conservatives have controlled for 15 years now. We'll get an update from meteorologist Jennifer Wojcicki coming up next. You're up north. Tomorrow, Sarah Godlewski's group Women Win Wisconsin is part of a large coalition with other organizations planning a series of at least a half dozen rallies across the state throughout the month of March, designed to give women and their allies a place to show their support for reclaiming the freedom to make their own choices about their bodies and their health care. She'll tell us the where and when of those rallies. Also, Kyle Kaminsky from our sister outlet to Up North News, The Gander in Michigan, will talk about Michigan's 4 years of legalizing marijuana and what lessons Wisconsin could learn from that. So again, that's all tomorrow here on Up North News Radio. But coming up now, weatherology updates from meteorologist Jennifer Wojcicki, who joins us on this Tuesday morning at quarter past the hour. Jennifer, good morning. How are things looking out there?
Good morning. Laura Lockwood here, filling in for Jenny today.
Hi, Laura. How are you?
Doing great. Got my coffee. I'm all set. How are you?
Doing very well, thanks, because we didn't get the pummeling yesterday that we knew we weren't going to get pummeled, but it's winter. You never know for sure. These big fat flakes fell on Lake Wissota in the afternoon, but the temperature stayed above freezing, and so things were slick for a time. But again, it could have been a lot worse, and it's a good reminder that we still have some winter ahead of us.
Oh, indeed, indeed. Oh, yeah. As a matter of fact, we have another system coming in here tonight. It's going to be impacting a good chunk of our state. So definitely want to be aware of that. And still quite a bit of weather to come as far as winter goes. We have at least one more month, and we all know how Wisconsin goes. So we actually theoretically could be having a few more months of winter. Just as long as the lakes open up before opener, I'll be happy.
There you go. That is very key, especially up here on Wissota. I appreciate hearing that.
Yeah, exactly. So we'll hopefully have those lakes opened up. But until then, yeah, a lot of winter yet to come. We have temperatures today that are going to be climbing anywhere from the low 40s near the Milwaukee area towards Madison 42. And then as you head further north, they do cool a bit into the mid-30 range, but still not bad for this time of the year. Lots of sunshine out there helping us out with that ahead of the next system coming in. And that'll be coming in here tonight, mainly impacting the northwest portion of the state where we are looking at picking up some minor accumulations of snow. Meanwhile, a little bit further south, we'll have more of that wintry mix associated with that. So be aware, roads can become a little slippery with this system here. So as we head into tonight, we could be picking up a dusting in the southern portion of the state, closer to about a half an inch to an inch as you head further north. And then as you head into Wednesday, this is when we could see a little bit more accumulation across the northern portion of the state, closer to about a half to an inch. Meanwhile, further south, looking a little drier. It's just kind of a glancing blow from that system. Temperatures Wednesday, still looking at the mid to upper 40s across the southern portion of the state, mid 30s across the central, and then dropping into the upper 20s as you head closer to Lake Superior. As we head into Thursday, fairly quiet weather, so that's good news, but there is another system creeping through the southern portion of our area here. As we finish out the work, we could see a few light showers from that near Illinois area, but otherwise looking pretty quiet across most of the state here, just a few clouds getting thrown over from that system off to our south. So not too bad of a forecast, but definitely want to be aware tonight into tomorrow. We do have that system that will be working its way through the area here.
And that evergreen reminder for road conditions from the Wisconsin Department of Transportation, go to 511wi.gov. Weatherology meteorologist Laura Lockwood, nice to talk to you. Thank you so much. Have a great day.
You too. And Mike will be with you tomorrow.
All right. We'll look for that. Thank you. All right. There's Laura. There's an update on the weather for us. And let's look at, we're gonna look at the issue of student loan debt forgiveness. But I was reminded before I leave the topic of road conditions in the state. And Aaron, this is something that I don't know if you're, are you familiar with the app Waze, W-A-Z-E?
I am not.
Okay. So now are you, when you do directions, are you more of an Apple Maps person or a Google Maps person? Do you still buy the paper ones at the gas station and fold them every which way?
I wouldn't be opposed to having a paper map in my car or something like that. Definitely have.
But when you're getting direct, when somebody gives you directions to a place, you're typically following one of those Google or Apple Maps, aren't you?
Yeah, I use Google Maps.
You use Google Maps.
Okay. I have an Android phone.
I had heard of Waze, and I know that I'd heard that it's popular out east. It might be out west. I'm not sure, but I knew very little people who used it. During our trip in early January down to Costa Rica, I noticed that the person we were with had a map app on their dashboard, but I'd never seen anything like it before, and asked her about it, and she said it was Waze and that everybody down there uses Waze. And so I've since poked around and taken a look at it, and I'm bringing it up only because as I was looking at the 511wi.gov map, it includes little map indicators for Waze reports. In other words, users of Waze can, you know, tap the screen and report, you know, that there's construction or, you know, something else that's slowing down traffic. And so it's just got me thinking out loud as to whether, you know, Waze is something that's in use more often around here than I thought, or if it's still something that's rather, you know, nascent out here in the Midwest compared to the coast. So I just wanted to see your thoughts on that as I was looking at the road condition reports. The United States Supreme Court is going to be taking up the case of student loan debt and the arguments over one of the more ambitious pieces of executive action in the Biden administration's history. And that would be a plan that would wipe out about $400 billion in student loan debt using the coronavirus pandemic as a hook. Now, look, setting aside the coronavirus pandemic for a second, just on the issue of student loan debt, which now is something like $2 trillion and has absolutely crippled the younger parts of the middle class because student higher education costs have gone through the roof since people in my generation went to school, when you could afford to go to school based on a summer job. But the failure of politicians over the years to have student aid, financial aid, keep up with the cost of higher education has led more people than ever to have to take out loans that are taking longer and longer to pay back. And as they do, banks benefit, federal government benefits, but that's also money that could have been used by these younger families to buy a home, to buy a new car instead of the 10-year-old one that they got in high school and they're still putting mileage on, and so forth. And so advocates, long before the coronavirus pandemic, have been saying that if the federal government were to forgive and write off a certain percentage of student loan debt, that it would be it would provide true economic impact. It would be a real economic stimulus package. So just keep that in mind, that when you hear about the coronavirus pandemic and this Supreme Court case, there have been people long before the pandemic making the case that we have basically let student loan debt get far too high in this country, and that by forgiving some of it, you have an economic stimulus tool. Okay, being whether that be the case or not, in your mind, the administration has been using a law from 2003 called the Higher Education Relief Opportunity for Students Act. It's shorthand the HEROES Act. And this was passed in 2003, you know, around the, you know, post 9/11, the Iraq War, giving the Secretary of Education the power to waive or modify any regulatory provisions that would protect borrowers who are affected by a war or other military option or national emergency. Well, there's no doubt that the COVID-19 pandemic was a national emergency. In fact, Donald Trump said so. While president in March of 2020, he declared the pandemic to be a national emergency. And at the time, the Trump administration invoked the HEROES Act to pause student loan repayment requirements and to suspend the accrual of interest. And that, of course, continued into the first year of the Biden administration, when, you know, the vaccine was just coming on board. We were still losing thousands of people a day, were losing their lives of all ages, of all walks of life, as we were waiting for this vaccine to be developed and take hold. So the Biden administration continued all of this. But then last August, the administration said it was going to switch gears, end the repayment pause, and instead forgive $10,000 in debt for individuals who earn under $125,000 a year, or $250,000 per household. And it would be $20,000 worth of relief for those who got Pell Grants from low-income families. And I'll quickly make the personal note that I'm one of those people from way back in the day, in the early 80s. The only reason I could afford to go to college, coming from a family that was flat broke for generations, was because of Pell Grants. And I have repaid that exponentially in the higher taxes that I am able to pay, because my income is so much better because of the higher education that I received. So there's already a soft spot in my heart for people who get Pell Grants, are willing to work hard, graduate, take that education, and, you know, become tax-paying citizens in this country. And so you already have people from Pell Grants and other forms of student aid seeing some relief from the Biden administration. Well, enter the Republicans, who want to make the case that that the law should not apply, that it's overreach on the part of the Biden administration, and that the Biden administration is relying too hard on things that do not have explicit congressional authority. And in fact, the court has started to insist more on clear congressional authority, something that it calls the major questions doctrine. And back in June, the court invoked this major questions doctrine in a decision that curtailed the Environmental Protection Agency's power to address climate change, because without clear congressional authorization, the court said the agency could not take that action. Chief Justice John Roberts employed the phrase for the first time and said that it was meant to address a particular and recurring problem in his view, and that is agencies asserting highly consequential power beyond what Congress could reasonably be understood to have granted. And it's that same doctrine, that same conservative originalist intent doctrine, that has allowed the court to rule that the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, was not authorized to impose a moratorium on evictions, and that OSHA was not authorized to tell large employers to have their workers vaccinated against COVID-19, and so forth. But again, that originalist point of view on what agencies can or can't do in their lane of, you know, what they're working on, what they are charged to do, this is problematic to me. And I simply use the same language that I use all the time when people talk about original intent and that you should only be able to do whatever is explicitly spelled out. And that is, I guess airplanes are illegal. I guess we can't have an Air Force because airplanes weren't in the, you know, they weren't written into the Constitution because they didn't exist. Man didn't know how to fly back then. We have always taken into account the changes in society, the advances in society, while still respecting the lanes with which you are governing something, whether it's the transportation department or, you know, OSHA or the EPA or what have you. But this very conservative majority on the court is quite likely to strike down student loan debt forgiveness because what was a national emergency in 2003, in their mind, isn't a national emergency in 2023. And that's just wrong. Back with Hans Breiten Moser after this. You're up north.
Follow Up North News with our daily newsletter. Go to our website, upnorthnewswi.com, and click newsletter on the top banner. Once again, here's Pat Kreitlow.
He just takes the tractor another round and pulls a plow across the ground.
And again, a happy birthday to Jason Aldean, turning 46 years old today. Hans Breitenmoser is back. We haven't been able to talk to Hans in a while. He's been a traveling man, as dairy farmers are wont to do this time of year when you can have somebody else milking, but there's no field work to be done. Hans, good to see you again. Have you had a good few weeks here since our last visit?
Yep, you bet, Pat. Back in the colder climes here, but happy to be back.
Yeah. I, you know, it's something, again, being married into a dairy farm family, there's rarely a day off. And so when you get that chance, you want to make the most of it. So glad you got to, and it's good to talk to you again. It's our first conversation since Governor Tony Evers introduced his budget proposal. Again, for folks not familiar with the state budget process, the governor of any party, whoever it is, proposes a budget. Normally, the legislature uses that as a base and takes things out and puts things in and turns it into something. Republicans, for now, this is the third Tony Evers budget, and in all three have engaged in the disrespectful motion of taking the Evers budget and putting it into a garbage can and saying, we'll start with our own base, thank you very much. And that's fine. That's their right to be, you know, political jerks if they want to, but it doesn't mean we can't talk about what the governor has proposed and the things that could be good and that Republicans in the legislature would be well advised to pay attention to because they would benefit their mostly rural districts. And so we're going to talk a bit about that with Hans this morning. We'll start with the things that we know, you know, off the top, the things that everybody can kind of lay their hands on. You can touch a bridge and a road and a school and things like that. And although the big city projects get a lot of attention, you know, the Marquette Interchange in Milwaukee back in the day and things like that, there's no shortage, Hans, of roads and bridges and other infrastructure in rural Wisconsin that would benefit from continued investment by the state budget.
Oh, that is so true, Pat. And having been on the county board for 10 years up here in Lincoln County, that was, I mean, we were talking about potholes all the time. So, yeah, money that gets invested into infrastructure is a good investment. And I don't know why that has to be so politically charged. Again, it's just a symptom of where we're at today. So if the Democrat says one thing, the Republicans are going to be against it and vice versa to a certain extent. So, but that's so unfortunate because, you know, I've said all along, all this infrastructure, regardless if you're farming or have any other kind of business, or if you're just trying to get to work, is important. And the broadband is hugely important. So these are good investments. And the other thing that I think that our politicians and policymakers need to remember is that this money that's invested goes directly into our communities. These dollars bounce around in our communities. It's all too often we have this conversation saying, well, we're going to spend all this money like it's magically going to disappear. But that's not the case at all. These dollars reproduce to beat hell when you stick them into infrastructure projects. All those guys that are working on those roads, they're buying gas, they're hitting the taverns after work, and those monies are moving around.
And there is no doubt that there was a time when Republicans were the party of infrastructure. One need only look at Tommy Thompson And it's not just about Highway 29, but he understood the value from rural Wisconsin of investing in these things that, like you said, now they just kind of lump everything into spending. And then they say, well, we don't know what he, you know, how these other things. Again, you can't wish these things into existence. You have to have the leadership to actually spend the money to do it. Now, the same can be said with things that you can't really put your hands on, but are just as critical. For example, we have tremendous workforce needs in the state. We have a labor shortage. Part of that is because childcare is becoming less affordable all the time to families. There are this affordable housing is not nearly the big city problem it is compared to rural areas where, you know, if a business or a manufacturing plant, you know, wanted to expand and add workers, you know, those potential workers come and find that there'd really be no place to live around their area. You could add vocational training to the mix so that people could come in and be ready to work right away. These are all things that are in Governor Evers' budget proposal. And again, Hans, it seems like these are the kinds of investments. If you were saying, what do you need to do in rural Wisconsin? You'd include these intangibles in your budget as well.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we see that in our area. We've had, sort of an affordable housing shortage for many years. And that does leave our local businesses struggling because, they'll put together a package and make it, you know, so that they can attract employees. But if the employees can't go, if they can't move in, then it's a non-starter. And I would take that a step further. The other thing that was interesting is this idea of taking 20% of the state sales tax to aid local governments. And again, having been in local government, that's a big one. That's really big because like here in Lincoln County, our county board ended up getting rid of extension, for example. And our rural school systems are also struggling and have been for years. These are the kinds of things that if we can get dollars at the local level to, you know, keep these types of infrastructure, things like extension and so forth in place, it makes our rural areas attractive to young people who are starting families and have to put kids in school and want to have resources for kids like 4-H and that type of stuff. Those are, again, like you said earlier, they're intangible. They're not as obvious as, you know, laying a mile of blacktop, but they're so very, very important for rural areas to be able to, get some folks to move back to the rural areas rather than everybody migrating to the larger metropolitan areas.
Exactly. And then we also can't forget the healthcare aspect of it. The governor has again tried to get the legislature to understand that accepting the Medicaid funding, Wisconsin's one of only 12 states that is burning money rather than providing healthcare to a lot of folks across rural Wisconsin who could use a more affordable healthcare coverage.
Yeah. And I've been saying that for years. I mean, that should be simple, low-hanging fruit. Again, if we could get the politics out of it. But when you start talking about the money people spend on healthcare and how those dollars could be better spent if they had them better used in our communities and so forth, it just having affordable healthcare is the most liberating thing that young families and people who are looking to start businesses can possibly have. It's so easy and it's right there in front of us and it would solve so many problems, but we just can't get over that hump for silly political reasons. And it's very, very frustrating.
And you're right. It is just silly political reasons. One that would be, I guess, controversial, but I'm sure that much of rural Wisconsin is aware that there are many undocumented immigrants here. Frankly, our farm economy might very well collapse if they all went away. And so the governor is proposing allowing those who are in the country, who maybe came with their parents, so they were too young to document themselves, but here they are, and allow them to pay in-state tuition rates at UW system schools. And I just talked, Hans, in the last segment about coming from a low-income family and how Pell Grants and other financial aid helped me earn an education and become a productive Wisconsin taxpayer, and why you wouldn't want that for the children of immigrants so that they too would have a greater chance to become, you know, tax-paying citizens of the state. I don't see the reason why not to, again, unless, like you said, it's silly politics.
Well, it is silly politics, and then it takes it to another level of silly, xenophobic, just stupidity in general. Again, if we look at education the way we used to look at education and view it as an investment in our future, then, you know, it's no different than saying to a childless couple, well, of course you're expected to pay taxes to help support the local school system, because guess what? Those young people are going to be the people who are going to be generating the dollars that move around in the economy and take care of you and in your old age. That's how that was the agreement for many, many years in this country. And it worked really, really well. I mean, the reason the United States got to where it was largely because of affordable public education, or accessible public education. The affordability part of it was taken care of by our tax dollars, because we understood that it was a good investment. So to deny that to people who, you know, whose parents have, you know, a different background is just silly. It just, again, look at it as an investment and it will pay, you know, 100-fold.
There's a lot of these are big picture items that have both, you know, rural and urban impacts. There are other things that are specifically targeted toward the farm economy and the rural economy. And Hans, if you'll excuse me, I'm going to read through several of them at once and then just give you the opportunity to pick any one of them or comment overall about them. For example, there's going to be $2 million for the Wisconsin Initiative for Agricultural Exports to support dairy and crop and meat sales overseas. It provides export education, helps dairy processors engage in key international trade shows and marketing campaigns. There is $1.5 million in funding for the Dairy Processor Grant Program. There is $30 million directed to the Food Security Initiative that helps support food banks and pantries so that they're getting fresh Wisconsin-grown food in there, not just processed food. And then there's $15 million for the Dairy Innovation Hub. This is run at 3 UW campuses with a mission to produce nutritious dairy foods in an economically, environmental, and socially sustainable manner. And that hub has funded more than 130 projects. These are all the little things that don't get talked about much when we talk about state budgets or federal budgets, but that's where the work gets done in these individual lines. And the fight becomes, from the line, is this worthy of funding? And then on the line, what should that dollar amount be? And I just wanted your own thoughts on some of those targeted investments in the rural economy.
Well, I think they're all good. I mean, I think it makes sense for us, knowing how important ag is, and specifically the dairy part of ag, how important that is to our economy in the state of Wisconsin. It's huge. Nothing comes close to it. So it's important that we have public policy that's supportive of that. And I think also not from just from the economy standpoint of it, but just from rural fabric kind of cultural standpoint, to maintain that ag bent and that dairy culture, I think is important. I think, you know, in order to do that, we should be looking for these export opportunities, and also, you know, looking at how we can do these things environmentally friendly and in an environmentally friendly way and so forth. So I think these dollars are well intended in terms of looking at how we maintain an industry in a sustainable manner going forward, because we see how important that industry was to our state and all the people in our state. So it makes sense to be supportive of that. Politicians and policymakers are in a position where they're picking and choosing, I think some of the things that we spoke about earlier are more important, simply because there's no industry there that can take care of those projects, those infrastructure projects and so forth, public school funding and so forth are things that are more broadly taken care of historically, obviously, because they're not specific to one industry. So I would certainly prioritize those. But I think some of the Dairy Innovation Hub, for example, I think are important to the state. And I think they do have an impact indirectly on everybody in the state.
I think they do as well. And then, a couple of other quick notes. There would be an Office of Environmental Justice to combat pollution and water contamination, because, again, most farmers want to be good stewards of the land, and expanded access to mental and behavioral health services in order to reduce suicide rates, a special problem across rural Wisconsin. Hans Breitenmoser, good to reconnect with you. Thanks again. Glad you had some great travels, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Thanks a lot, Pat. Appreciate the opportunity.
All right. When we come back, we will talk to Chad Holmes from Bull Falls Radio and find out what he's been covering up in the Wausau area and what he's got coming up in terms of all the high school sports that he covers as well. That's all right after this break. You're up north. All right, here's Chad Holmes from Bull Falls Radio joining us from up in the Wausau area, covering the veritable truckload of news and the double truckload of high school sports this time of year. So we never run short of conversation fodder with Mr. Holmes. How are you today?
Doing good, Pat. How about you?
Really good. Really good. Let's start on the lighter note first, because we've got some news notes about the school consolidation plan in Wausau. We've got sports to talk about. But I don't want to forget, before we get to talking here, we've made note that it's Girl Scout cookie time. And I just want to know, in the Holmes household, what do you end up stocking up on? Are you a thin mint guy, or one of these more exotic flavors out there?
I am the chocolate stripes. I've always enjoyed the
Samoas or the Caramel Delights, whatever, they've gone by both names. So that's the one we're talking about.
Yes, it is.
Oh God. I
enjoy those.
I could eat those just all the time.
Well, that's it. Once you start, you go through an entire roll right away.
Oh, it's so easy.
You don't have one or two. You just keep going. It's like, oh,
you find yourself going, you just had a third one, so what's wrong with a fourth one?
Exactly.
Right? Yeah. And then we were talking as well about, what new flavors would you create? And I have to admit to a stunning lack of creativity on that one. I would like maybe take my favorite candy bar, which is Kit Kats, and turn that into a cookie. Or, other people might be more ambitious, maybe one that tastes like Guinness beer. I don't know. But think about that. We'd like your thoughts on what you would do. And what, here's another one. What are the cookies that would be quintessentially Wisconsin? And please do not suggest a bratwurst flavored cookie. I'm not down with that, but maybe there's something else. Mr. Holmes, you are so busy. And even on your show this afternoon from 2 to 4 on Bull Falls Radio up in Wausau, you are going to be talking about the still controversial school consolidation plan. We had been calling it a proposal, but it is a plan now that the school board has voted on it. And yet that's not stopping some folks, quite a few folks in the community, from saying maybe this shouldn't be advancing so quickly. What is being proposed, and what kinds of things are you expecting to talk about this afternoon?
Well, there's a couple of tracks actually today, because last night there was another school board meeting it was a committee, but the entire board was there with the exception of one. And they were talking about where they're going from here. They talked about transportation issues. They talked about the potential of a non-binding referendum. And along that line, there is a Wausau parent and resident, Nora Brown, who has organized a petition, and over the last about 4 days or so, and according to the last numbers I saw, that was early yesterday, they had about 1,100 people who had signed the petition, and she just against this consolidation plan, and I'm going to talk to her about what she is doing, what she has found out, because obviously when you get all these folks together, they discuss, and I think, you know, I think there are some people that have different problems with it. It's not all just one problem. It's, you know, these people have different, well, some may be against the plan itself, some may be against the time frame itself, against the communication aspect of it. So we're going to talk about that and find out what she ultimately wants. And also last night there was discussion about this idea of having a non-binding referendum. No decision has been made, but also talking about surveys of getting people's ideas as well, because during the process, they're going to continue the process. They've decided on this road right now, but in terms of you know, there's still possibilities of changes as we move forward.
Okay. And you know, when we talked about that last week, you know, essentially the thrust of our conversation was, look, the vote has been held, kind of a no backsies thing, you know, unless there's another school board election and the membership changes. But you know, the plan has been voted on, and you know, let's see how the implementation rolls out. But even having said that, the implementation of any given plan is going to change as it goes along, and that not just because of, you know, cost overruns or construction delay, you know, all the usual factors, but frankly, sometimes other ideas come up where a school board or administration can say, you know, on second thought, maybe we make this adjustment to the plan. And so I guess what I'm trying to say is, while I'm sure there are still folks that would like to put up just a full stop sign, maybe there are some other folks saying, okay, if this is going to go forward, could we at least try this route instead? Do you think that there's that sentiment out there, or is there still very much a show of support for how do we stop this thing entirely? And I'm thinking the advisory referendum might be a tactic toward that end.
Yeah, I think somebody that I trust, I'd spoken to just after the vote occurred, and I kind of agree with this. I think there's a sense out there that there's maybe a third of the people that are okay with the consolidation plan and that see the reasons for it. There's probably a third of the people out there that are against it. They like the current community schools, especially with the elementary schools and also the two high schools. And then there's probably another third that are not engaged. And even last night, I'm watching this meeting. I got home and it's on, they stream it. So I'm watching it and I see there's like 90 people watching it. So again, I know that they have an opportunity to watch it later and get information later, but again, that's always one of the things that is the factor. I mean, how many, even with a referendum, and there was a discussion last night about representative democracy. And again, that's a factor here as well, that the folks that have the most information are the ones on the board, and we decide to elect people to represent us because everybody has a lot on their plate in their everyday lives. So I mean, again, I just when I talk about this on the program, I talk about there's so many layers to this, and it's about trying to get as much information about, you know, where people stand on it, also where the board is coming from and where the future is going. And I think you hit it on the head. There's going to be changes. This is not, you know, in stone. The whole process is, I think, going to be, you know, there may be subtle changes, there may be significant changes. It's going to be interesting to see.
I think one of the most unfortunate terms in politics is low information voter, because you do have a hardcore group on one side, a hardcore group on the other side, and you're fighting over those folks in the middle who either by circumstance of their life or by intent don't take in a lot of information about an issue. And so you're trying to sway them one way or the other with political ads or personal visits or whatever. And rather than low information voter, I kind of think of them as the, you know, the busy people. And there's still a block of those who are saying, what is this all about? And it's where we really appreciate your willingness to shed some light on this on a weekly basis. I got about 10 seconds for you to tell me if there's any big headlines in high school sports or what overall is keeping you busiest this week.
Oh, we got state hockey coming up this week. Mosini from our area, first time in 15 years, making it down to state. And then basketball, girls and boys now in the playoffs.
All right, Chad Holmes, Bull Falls Radio. Good to talk to you. Have a great day. Take care.
You too, Pat.
All right. And that'll do it for us for a Tuesday. Have a great day. You can follow me at Pat Kreitlow Up North on Facebook. Otherwise, we'll see you back here tomorrow morning.